You can sit with us podcast with Lexi B.
Brandon William Jones is an entrepreneur, technology leader, investor, and board director. Today, Brandon is the founder and president of Gravy, a private membership organization and investment syndicate focused on building generational wealth through education, access, and community. Before founding Gravy, Brandon built a track record as a senior executive growing and scaling technology products into category leaders. Most recently, Brandon served as the VP and head of global sales development at ServiceNow. His organization was responsible for driving new business pipeline and grooming future sales leaders for one of the world's fastest growing enterprise software companies with over $1 billion in revenue. Brandon is a board of director and finance committee chair for Scan Group, which, after a combination with Care Oregon, expected to close in 2023, will form the Health Right Group, a community-based healthcare organization serving nearly 800,000 members with $6.8 billion in revenue. Brandon is also the board director and finance committee chair for the Scan Foundation.
You can sit with us podcast with Lexi B.
Welcome, Brandon. How are you?
I'm well, Lexi. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you. I must have been, you know, I'm big time now. I must have made it. I'm on Alexa.
You're crazy. How is Chevy Chase, Maryland? By the way, I did some research and Chevy Chase, Maryland is actually not named after Chevy Chase.
Yes. I had to look that up too, because it sounds like a crazy name when you first hear it. Yes, it is named after some older Caucasian gentleman from way back in the day.
Yes.
That is not related to the comedy, National Lampoon's Christmas holiday series. No, but the name is definitely a little bit, of an interesting name. So I have to explain this to a lot of people when I'm showing up.
I'm glad I'm not the only one who thought that, because I was like, wait a minute, like Chevy Chase really got his own city? Okay.
Yeah.
So what is in your coffee cup? What you drinking with us?
I'm drinking Synergy Raw Kombucha Gingerade, which is kind of like my favorite drink. It is great for any time of day. It's refreshing, has all kind of enzymes and things that are supposedly good for your gut health. And it's incredibly tasty. So that's what I have in my cup. I'm not a coffee drinker, though, believe it or not.
You've never had coffee?
I've had it like once and never really adapted. And I did, in my time in investment banking, I realized if I can get through investment banking without coffee, then,
you can do anything.
So I never really got into the coffee. Now, Charlotte, who was a prior guest on your show and a good friend of yours, I know, she's drinking coffee all day. Every day, French press, cold pour. She's serious about the coffee.
When did you get into kombucha? I feel like everyone that I know who drinks kombucha, there's always this like weird hipster story of how we got into it. So when did you get into kombucha?
Working at Google, you're introduced to a lot of bougie snacks. So yes. I worked for Google for 7 years, from 2013 through 2020. And went to the microfridge and saw some kombucha, drank it, and said, this is incredible. And that was my introduction to it. So, yes, not something I would have been exposed to had I not, kind of been in la-la land for corporate employees.
That was my first time drinking kombucha, too, working at Facebook. No, working at Airbnb, and they had kombucha on tap.
Really? Okay, so they took it to the next level. Okay.
I didn't like it, but I remember drinking it. They also had beer on tap, which is a whole separate conversation, but Airbnb made homemade kombucha. It was very granola in the best way. Shout out to the Airbnb food team. So where are your people from?
Chicago. So I was born and raised on the south side of Chicago, Illinois. My parents, their families came to Chicago through the Great Migration. My dad and his family is from Newport News, Virginia, Bad News, Virginia. And my mom and her family came from Itabena, Mississippi, which you probably never heard about, but is a small town in Mississippi. It's funny because I heard your prior episode with Charles Hudson, the legendary, and his family is from Mississippi as well through the Great Migration to Detroit. So, I love the fact that you asked this question, because there's a lot of through lines that kind of emerge that would not otherwise come to the surface had you not asked.
I mean, for all you know, maybe you and Charles are distant cousins. We should ask them.
It's possible. I look at Detroit as our cousins in Chicago.
See? So I'm like, maybe we're building familiar connections.
Exactly.
Shout out to Charles Hudson. So you have done so many things in your career. Like you said, you worked at Google, you were in investment banking, yeah. You were at ServiceNow, doing all the financial things. Mm-hmm. And recently, about what, 2 to 3 years ago, you founded this amazing platform, I want to call it, called Gravy, which is really talking about wealth generation, generational wealth. Mm-hmm. How do people figure out how to make wealth for their families? And I first want to ask you, what was the rationale, the impetus to even start this platform? I feel like Gravy low-key started as a newsletter and then became much bigger. Why did you do this? Like, were you in bed in the middle of the night? Like, we should talk about this. What really started this whole movement?
It's a great question. So this is actually around 2017. You know, I had this idea where, again, working as a, you know, very fortunate high earner employee for top tech companies, I was also surrounded by many other folks in those same situations, Facebook, Twitter, Airbnb. And what I realized was a lot of us, you know, were in many cases the highest earners maybe in our family, you know, and we were navigating this world where it was very clear to us, particularly if you're underrepresented, that a lot of your why is to build a legacy for the folks that come after you. You're very cognizant of how privileged you are in relative to many others from our communities to be in this spot. And it's important for us to figure out how do we take that and create more opportunities, not just for the, you know, for our offspring, but also for folks in our community. So this is something I found to be a commonality across many of my peers. But the other thing, which was kind of a head scratcher, was like, we didn't really talk about this stuff. You know, like we get together and we have conversations about, you know, how our career is going, you know, the ups and downs in our career. We talk about, you know, what we're watching, what we're listening to, music, but none of us were talking about what you could argue is kind of the most important underlying factor of, you know, what opportunity will be created for our family and community, which was like wealth, you know, wealth building. And we definitely weren't talking about it at a sophisticated level from my perspective. Another thing I noticed was, you know, a lot of folks might have like a financial advisor, et cetera, but oftentimes what was out there was like very cookie cutter, and it didn't seem like it really addressed all the elements of true wealth creation. So, you know, it's of course making money, saving money, but then on the investment side, you know, it really wasn't much in the way of like, you know, buying real estate. How do you go about buying real estate, right? You know, if you want to get into angel investing, how do you go about doing that? And it was just a lot of questions around the how and navigating generational wealth. And so when I kind of put the pieces together, I first started off just thinking like, hey, it would be nice to kind of break down these concepts just into simple peer-driven insights based on, you know, folks I know in my network who have navigated this, and I know a lot of people want to hear this. Let me just put the two sides together. And so, for example, we would talk to someone like an Arthur Johnson, who at the time was the chief strategy officer at Pure Storage. But while he was navigating his way through corporate, he built a portfolio of 53 units that ultimately matched what he was making in corporate America. But he did it while working full time, and he did it across 3 states. None of those states he actually lived in. Right. How did he do that? How did he put together his team? You know, how did he analyze the market? And he was loving and much, much excited about telling his story and kind of being that intermediary. So it started off as a newsletter. From there, we realized a lot of folks were looking to invest. And so we pulled together folks who had deal flow with folks who were accredited and wanted to invest and kind of created a syndicate. A lot of interesting deals came through the syndicate. Our first deal was Harvard. Was actually building a enterprise research campus, life sciences kind of lab type of deal, right on their campus. And they were looking to bring in minority investors on the equity side. And so we just happened to have this community of accredited investors who were looking to invest. And so we, you know, kind of put together our first SPV solely for the purpose of investing in that, you know, investment opportunity, which was a phenomenal one and continues to be. And that kind of led to just a lot of other deal flow coming our way from early stage tech companies, clean tech companies. We've done cannabis companies, and people just join the syndicate and get deal flow. There's no obligation to invest, but we try to really curate hard to get access to mission aligned companies or projects, you know, that we think that this community, one, can, you know, would benefit from the access, but two, could potentially add additional value within, you know, as a board advisor or strategic partner or collaborator as well. So what I'm most proud about is the type of folks we've curated through this community and having them collaborate in ways that were not intentional before. And you also, by the way, have been a contributor, so I want to shout you out.
Oh, well, thank you. I really want to just applaud that, because I remember being, 22, graduating from undergrad, starting my new job 3 weeks after I graduated, getting paid $80,000. And then, of course, because working in tech, getting this set of shares. I had no one in my life explain to me what share investment was. Right? No one had said like, oh, the company's giving you free stuff. And I worked for a publicly traded company. So for my first, I'll be frank, like 3 years at the company, I looked at my wealth or lack thereof, because family, 80 grand in the Bay is not a lot of money, as I'm getting paid 80 grand so I can spend 80 grand, right? Like that's the budget. I wasn't even thinking about savings. I'm not going to lie. There were many weeks, that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday before that paycheck, where P, B, and J was law in my house. And it wasn't until I actively looked for a financial advisor for me to understand savings, just basic savings, but also understand like investment and stock, because no one had talked to me about that. I knew the stock market was real. Right. I just didn't know what that thing was. So let's go into that. I'd love to talk to you about investing. What is investing in your core as a, former investment banker and the CEO of Gravy? What is investing 101?
Yeah, that's a great question. So at its core, I would call investing taking ownership. It's not something that you would directly kind of come up with. But if you think about it, let's talk about it. In theory, you can invest in yourself, through learning and building your skills. You can invest in others through time, mentorship, and then you can invest in assets, that ultimately you own and or control, which increase in value over time without you having to put in incremental work. I think doing all of those styles of investments are really important. And I think that's kind of core to what Gravy is. But really what it boils down to is, as you said, it doesn't matter what level you're at, whether you're making 80,000 or 800,000, and we know people making both. What are you doing to make sure that out of what you're making, you are putting that into assets that are going to increase in value that you'll control over time, that will not be tied to the individual effort that you're putting into making money? That's pretty much the bottom line. That being said, when I think about, you brought up the idea of like, hey, I got shares for the first time. The education part of what Gravy does to me is more important than the access to private investment opportunities that we offer, because, knowledge is power, so not only do folks not necessarily know, okay, I'm getting paid in shares, how does that work? But they don't realize, for example, the difference between short-term gains and long-term gains. They might, they might sell their shares not realizing that your taxes will be much less, if you hold them for a year, those shares, before you sell them, than if you hold them for a year. A lot of people don't know that. A lot of people know that you don't have to necessarily sell those shares to get liquidity. You can do what's called a margin loan, which is what a lot of the wealthiest people do in the US, right? You go to an interactive brokers or some type of brokerage that allows you to basically do kind of whatever the Fed rate is plus a small percentage, and you essentially loan them to yourself. And the worst case scenario is, based on how much leverage you take out on those shares, you might have to sell those shares if you, kind of go past the leverage amount that you're allowed on those shares, right? But the point is, you can take something that you already own, not sell it, but get liquidity to then maybe buy, we talked about this earlier, an accessory dwelling unit, right, for your property and fund that. So now you have something that's making you money, and then you can use that to pay back the loan on your shares, never having sold. So the last piece around ownership for me is not just placing that those funds into assets that are going to increase in value over time, but ideally not selling, or selling strategically in a way where you're not paying more taxes than you need to. Ideally, you're passing it on and not paying taxes at all, which is what the wealthiest do.
So let's talk about different forms of investment. We're going to break this down, and maybe we should have you back in season 3 and we can maybe target specific episodes, because I think that every form of investment probably needs its own mastermind class. So we have, investment that's easy to me because companies have given me this part of my negotiation, which is, welcome to XYZ company. We're going to give you X number of stocks. And if our company is public, that is on the stock market, you can choose to keep that stock on the stock market. You can choose to sell that stock when it vests. But the point is, we are giving this to you as a gift, talk to me about real estate investment. What is that?
Yes. So it's probably the, for many people, particularly in our community, the most approachable form of investment, because, you know, it's something that people can see, touch, feel, and ultimately live in. A little known fact about me is my first job out of college, I came out of Howard University in 03. My first job was at Johnson & Johnson, and I had a good friend and fraternity brother of mine who was working at Merck at the time. And we decided, while working, to form a real estate company, which consisted of us buying properties, rehabbing those properties, and then selling those properties at a profit. And then for a subset of those properties, keeping them and holding them and making rental income. And that's basically what real estate investing is. There's a lot of ways to play it. You know, you can do it passively, you know, literally through the stock market, you know, as a REIT, technically you're getting, you know, a proxy for ownership in real estate and exposure to that asset class. But for most people, they understand the idea of, okay, this is a house. I can buy this house. I can rent this house. And the magic in real estate is, you know, you have leverage, right? So you put down a down payment, and depending on, you know, your negotiation skills and what programs are available to you, in some cases you can put down as little as 5%. Or if you get what's called seller financing, you can put potentially nothing down and then acquire and control a property that you then rent. And whatever you're making above what that mortgage is, or that debt you took out on a property, is what you ultimately get to keep monthly. And then as a property, as we know, real estate generally goes up in value every year. You are also gaining from that additional, you know, gravy upside of appreciation. But you should never buy a property based on like speculation on appreciation. It should always be based on the fundamentals of the deal. But in essence, right, real estate is buying a property, you know, taking a loan out, buying a property, renting that property, or improving that property such that you've created value that you can either extract by selling, or by, even in some cases, refinancing or taking money out to buy another property. But either way, you're basically creating an asset and value through that asset that can then be leveraged for additional wealth creation.
I want to go back to the part where you said that at 23, you graduate from undergrad, and then you and your friend just happened to decide to have a, you know, passion for real estate. Where did that come from? I'm very curious, because when I was 23 and graduated, I still had a passion for expensive shoes. So my first side hustle was college counseling to buy shoes, not to buy real estate. So how did that come about?
Yeah, no, it's, I think one thing that's shared, you know, you see this a lot with folks, you know, from our community, is like a hunger, right? You know, an entrepreneurial drive. I think a lot of us understand, you know, early on that we want to control our destiny and we want to achieve financial freedom, right? We don't want to be beholden to someone else having to pay us a check, you know, every couple of weeks to survive. Like that's something that, at least for me, I knew early on, that's not what I wanted. I think then you say, okay, what are the avenues that I have awareness around that creates that level of diversification away from that corporate job, right? And I think there's a couple of things to say there. One, I don't think we're the best at awareness, right? And that's a big part of what Gravy's looking to do. So you know, you subscribe to our newsletter, you hear about investing in farmland, you know, buying a business, you know, black art, right? Passive income from real estate. A lot of what we're doing is looking to expose people. I think once you kind of get exposed to different areas, then you have to understand, like, what do you gravitate towards? And for some people, you gravitate towards something you can feel, touch. For other people, they might get excited about the research process, right? Behind, let's say, angel investing, like really digging into a business model, a founder's background, you know, kind of the economics of a business. I think that's the key, is like being exposed and then understanding what floats your boat and then pursuing that. For me, I had been exposed to real estate, and I could kind of understand at a basic level how I specifically could create value, right? And it's not a really complex business. It just comes down to a lot of hard work, research, and kind of sweat equity. And that's something that I felt like I could understand. One, and then two, this is the other piece I wanted to kind of highlight. It has to be complementary to what your bread and butter is, because I think a lot of people get it twisted. And their, what is called a side hustle, is actually making them less effective in their core thing. And that is not a good look, because it's short-sighted from the perspective of, if you can't fully do something on the side to replace your primary income, then you have to, you know, as Wahab on your podcast previously said, keep the main thing the main thing. And so real estate, also with a partner, felt like it was something that I could maintain and push forward while still also performing in my job, which is something I was able to do, you know, kind of top of the class of my, in my analyst class. I think that's really important to make sure you're strong in that situation. But just to kind of, you know, sum it up here, I think exposure, leaning into what resonates and then creating a system such that you can be successful in what is putting money on your table now, but also being able to push that ball forward with your strategic side hustle as well.
I also want to honor the fact that as a person who is getting into real estate, that real estate is much easier said than done, Brandon. And I think many times, especially in America, because the history of this country with land and wealth and how certain people just came and just took things from people, that we talk about real estate as this easy peasy thing if you have the money for the down payment. And I do want to just honor for 2 seconds that real estate is does take some work. It's not as simple as like go buy the house and then find some renters. it does take a little bit of finessing and a little bit of work, and it does take time.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. I think that's a really, important point. And just to dive into that a little bit, everything requires a lot of work. Anything that people think is easy, they're already mistaken, right? So this is kind of the idea of like picking your poison or choosing what resonates with you. I can go to a long set of stories around evictions of tenants, having to go in there with the sheriff to like physically evict someone out of a property. Situations where we've had somebody, you know, back then who was a hoarder and created just this crazy living situation in their unit, right? Dealing with contractors who were untrustworthy. So it is not by any means, and it's like you said, it's not easy work, but it's also like literally dirty work. A lot of times you have to get hands on. And for that point in my life, I had the ultimate sense of humility. Like that was something I actually leaned into because I knew without any, you know, any sense of, hey, this is beneath me. Like I knew that that could actually be a competitive advantage for me at the time. So I felt comfortable with it primarily because I really understood it. And also I was kind of good with numbers. I had a partner who also was good with numbers. And I think it all of this always boils down to numbers plus a level of micromanaging the details and being willing to get hands-on in a situation where it's needed. And so, yeah, you kind of brought up an important point because nothing about what we were doing was sexy. However, had we presented to someone else as, hey, we, you know, we own 9 units, you know, et cetera, you know, we bought a house, you know, rehabbed it. Like a lot of people say, oh, yeah, you know, I'm in, right? You know, show me how to do it. But no, they need to understand that, you know, 95% of what we were doing was not sexy.
And I love the part that you said, pick your poison, because everything that looks easy actually is work. Because, you know, Brandon, in these streets these days, I think with the, you know, with the TikToks and the Instagram and the social media, it highlights the reward. And we don't do enough of like highlighting how we got to the mountaintop, which is one of the reasons why I create this podcast. So now let's talk about angel investing. What is that? And how do people high level tap into that?
You know, I think this is probably, it's a great through line to the last question you asked, which is angel investing is ultimately, I would say generally you're looking at $25,000 or more that you're investing into a company, a private company that is early stage generally, although the term angel investor actually can be any at any point through the cycle, but you're doing it as an individual investor or maybe as part of an angel group. And so you're usually investing in this company for a small piece of ownership, and you're expecting basically to hold on to that investment for 7 years to 10 years before you get any return on that investment. And the numbers when it comes to angel investing are very much skewed towards a diversification game. So if you're going to angel invest, you have to be prepared to come in investing in 20 companies, right? And understanding it's going to be a law of averages. But the long story short is it's investing in companies that you believe in who have strong potential based on the founder's background, as well as the business model and their early economics and traction, but taking on the risk of them not necessarily executing fully on their promise and investing at a stage where you're hoping to grow with them over time and benefit from their outsized performance. So that's kind of the definition of it. I can definitely kind of talk about how I, you know, kind of got into the space. At this point, angel investment for probably 6 years and 40 or so angel investments during that time.
In that 40, how many of them have actually you received a profit? Because it sounds like to me, angel investment, it's also a gamble, right? You give X amount of money. Mm-hmm. We pray to the deity council that it works out. And if it doesn't work out, we don't get that money back. So out of that 40 yeah. from your experience, how many of them do you think you probably got something back? And how many of them it was like, it was a loss, but we're going to continue trying anyway?
That's a great question. So I'm going to have to pull up my little spreadsheet here where I track all this stuff.
I love a good spreadsheet.
Three of our companies were acquired.
Okay.
One of them did well on the acquisition. The other two were pretty much break even.
Okay.
We had one outright exit through an IPO, which did generally well. I would say that's probably on the high side of things.
Okay.
We've had funds that we've invested in, because I've also invested in venture funds that have returned to investors capital from an exit. And that's done generally well for two of the funds that I've invested in that have achieved those outcomes. And then the rest are still in play. And so the way we look at that is generally when you invest in angel companies, and sometimes you do it, you know, directly, sometimes you do it through a syndicate, but you're hoping to get quarterly updates from the company that show performance metrics, and ideally also getting, you know, as close to real-time valuations based on additional funds they've raised at a certain valuation, so that you can kind of track the value of your portfolio over time. But roughly, I calculate this maybe last month. And again, you have to kind of take it with a grain of salt, because a lot of valuations are changing. A lot of times folks don't raise because maybe the market hasn't done as well and they don't want to kind of submit a down valuation. But we're at about a 40%, 41% IRR which is kind of how you measure returns for our portfolio today, which is pretty good.
Okay. So in a perfect world, as an angel investor, what do you want? Do you want the company to get acquired? Do you want the company to go public? Like, in a perfect world, what is the outcome that you would like as the angel investor?
In a perfect world, you want to invest as early as possible in a company at the lowest price that's going to be extremely successful in the shortest amount of time.
Got it.
That's in a perfect
world. Okay.
The reality, though, and where I want to, you know, kind of go back to your original point around this idea of risk and things looking easy, you know, nowadays, you can actually angel invest through platforms that are crowdfunding platforms, meaning you don't have to be an accredited investor, which basically means you have a net worth, not including your home, of, you know, $1 million or more, or you're making $250K a year, you know, or kind of meeting criteria of someone who has money to lose as a proxy. So for that reason, the government, I can get into a whole kind of talk on how this may not necessarily be inclusive for folks from underrepresented backgrounds. In theory, you're not able to access the private markets because, you know, you're not sophisticated enough to invest in those companies. And unfortunately, particularly over the last decade or so, a lot of the outsized returns have happened in the private markets that many folks have been kind of locked out of. That's number one. But at the same time, we've seen the emergence of like crowdfunding platforms where you can invest in companies and not be accredited. They have different disclosure guidelines and there's certain caps on how much you can invest through those vehicles, but you can get access to these companies. Unfortunately, there's definitely a correlation between how exclusive an investment is generally and the return profile on that investment, all things created equal. You know, something that is now for the masses to invest in, that's not an IPO, but it's a private investment, generally is going to be something that is going to be overlooked or not participated in by a lot of the folks that would be considered the smart money. So for folks that are like starting angel investing, I think the first thing to do is read a couple books. I would recommend Angel by Jason Calacanis. Folks like Charles Hudson who's been on your podcast, a number of talks on how to approach investing, you know. And I think the biggest thing is, you know, ultimately what it boils down to is your networks. So if you know someone who is a professional investor who has performance, investing through their fund or investing alongside their fund is probably the safest way to go. The second piece would be, you know, syndicates. So Gravy has a syndicate. There's a lot of syndicates that, you know, that exist. Many of them have specific theses. The thesis can be around, you know, space investing or healthcare or, you know, underrepresented founders. I think looking at the track record of those syndicates and the companies within that portfolio and how they've done is really important, you know, in the early diligence phase. But also, syndicates don't necessarily require you to invest alongside with them. So you can join as many syndicates as you want and get that deal flow and have your own thesis around what you feel, one, you're drawn to as a space, but also you can build a critical mass of insight for that specific vertical based on your focus on that vertical. And when I first started off angel investing, you know, all my angel investments were done through a syndicate. My first four angel investments were done through a syndicate called Space Angels. At the time, I spent a lot of time reading this book called The Case for Space. I really believe that they're calling it space, but I thought, you know, kind of satellite technology and communications was the future. And I wanted to get more exposure, but I didn't have the expertise. So I joined Space Angels, which was an angel group that was known for 20 years in the space as only investing in space and space enabled companies. And so I, you know, joined that syndicate. I, you know, listened to a bunch of the different, you know, companies that came in that, you know, the syndicate was reviewing, got comfortable with a few of them, talked to a guy who was, you know, we featured in one of our Unpacked conversations, really good guy. His name is Justice Killian, who is a VP there. And he's the one that runs the analysis and kind of just understanding, asking a bunch of questions around the space. Ultimately, we made, you know, four investments in the space across the spectrum of stages. We invested in this company called Made in Space, which was a acquired, and it was pretty much like a break even situation. This was after, you know, 3 months of investing in it. We invested in this other company, Isotropic Systems, which has done okay, but not great. We invested in SpaceX a few rounds ago. That's definitely grown, and I think the other piece is like you have to look at the exit. So this is, you know, one of your questions earlier is what do you hope for? You want liquidity at the end of the day. But you have to be comfortable with holding on to things for a long period of time. So I would not recommend angel investing for people who do not have the capital to diversify broadly, one, and they don't have the wherewithal to wait 7 to 10 years for an exit. But that was another one. And then the biggest one that we invested in that was a 30x return on paper to date is a company called Arbol Markets, which is basically the new age of weather insurance. So if you, let's say you have farmers, they have to essentially protect their crops against like an ice storm or some type of weather risk that would then, you know, essentially diminish the value of the crops, right? So there's like this whole insurance world around crop protection. The new innovation is blockchain will essentially create a smart contract that based on data that comes in immediately cashes out an insurance policy based on it rained in this specific zip code or it snowed in this specific zip code. So it's not based on folks having to do this, all this underwriting. Is literally counterparties signing up for an outcome that is informed by a, you know, a data feed that is objective. And so that kind of opened up this new, it's called parametric risk insurance. This whole new space that is growing and they've done really, really well. So that's just kind of four example, four investments that we participated in, the outcome of those investments, and kind of how I approached that in the earliest stages, just to kind of get comfortable with the space in general and leveraging a lot of smart folks and a lot of research, you know, to get to the space where I was comfortable investing in those companies.
What I loved most about everything you just said is this concept of research, because it sounds like when it comes to angel investing, or take that back, it sounds like when it comes to investment in general. And right now we're talking about stock market, we're talking about real estate, we're talking about angel investment. It sounds like you've done so much research for you to make the best decision for you. Let's go deeper into that so folks can really understand that regardless of what you invest in or how you invest in, like y'all need to read a book or two and make sure that your mind, body, and spirit is comfortable with putting your money in this. And in the event it doesn't work out, you do not regret. How do you start your research as you do your, you know, multi-layer investments? What's the first thing you do when you're like, I'm thinking about it. Let me go read some things and get confident.
No, that's a really good question. I think there's three elements, right? And I think people can lean into these elements based on their own personal approach, but I think these are important. So the first is like, what is your zone of competency as a professional, right? So for me, you know, I had already had a background in, you know, finance, having worked in investment banking, like I understood, you know, income statements, balance sheets, et cetera, right? So you need to make sure you have a core set of, I can analyze a company and be comfortable doing that. That's number one, right? Because marketing is different from what's happening under the hood. You need to be comfortable looking under the hood and or having other people alongside you who are comfortable doing that. And maybe you have a complementary skill set, right? Which is, I have the ability to understand, you know, what's happening in this specific space because I work, you know, in this industry, in this space. Let's just say ad tech, for example, right? So I know ad tech. I may not be, you know, the best analyst of financial statements, but believe me, I know who the players are, I know what the competitive dynamics are, you know, I know where the space is going, I know how much like the space is growing, these types of things. So for me personally, you know, I spent a long time basically in go-to-market roles, you know, so I ran sales development for Google Cloud Americas, I ran sales development for all of LinkedIn's business lines in North America, and then, you know, ran all of global sales development for ServiceNow. So I knew anything, you know, I sat on first rounds advisory council for go-to-market. Same is true for Graycroft, which is another VC, their go-to-market council. So you kind of have a strong sense of what you actually do day to day. That's where I would say people should start. And that's number one. The second piece is like, you also have your own interests, right? And interests are things that you know you're willing to put the energy in to learn about. You may not be there, but you're committed, right? And so you read. So for me, space investing would fall into that category. Had I done anything in my career to intersect with space? Maybe a little bit. I also ran product operations for Google's Advanced Technology and Products Group as well for a couple years, but super lightweight, right? You know, so I read this book, A Case for Space, which kind of really dove into where the industry is today, where it's going, what are the sub industries within space, et cetera, et cetera. And then started to speak to people, you know, and I think that interest driven curiosity is really important because a lot of times people aren't necessarily doing what they are passionate about. And I think that in many cases, passion might actually have you put more energy into understanding and also networking and building authentic relationships with people in this space. And they can sense that. And in building those relationships, maybe they will put you onto an opportunity, right, that falls into that space that you wouldn't have heard about, you know, otherwise. The third piece is the collaborative approach, right? So Lexi, you, me, you know, John and Christina, we're going to get together every week. We are going to look at companies in these two or three spaces, and we are going to divide and conquer, right? Again, I know this market, you know, financial statements, you may be a networker who is connected to a lot of folks in the space. How do we put our heads together? What is essentially what a syndicate really is, you know, at the end of the day, when you have active participants, but how do we kind of divide and conquer and combine forces to get the best access, run the best analysis at scale, and then ultimately combine our funds so that we are more interesting to the company that, you know, we're looking to invest in? Because that's another big part of it, which is bigger checks get more attention and cap table space, right? And that's another big part of access.
I think that's really important. I think the idea of, you know, community, once again, community going together, you can get someplace farther than by yourself. I love this idea of syndicates, you know, sexy term for almost think tank sessions of how can we collectively work together and collectively have a common goal to get there faster and even get more out of it, it sounds like, right?
100%. And a lot of folks, simply knowing that you are out looking for investments, you'll get deal flow. And then your problem becomes, how do I filter it down, right? So as you start to build systems in place, you have to say, okay, I have a set of criteria that no matter how compelling this is, I'm going to narrow it down based on this, right? It's stage. You know, is it, how early is this company? Have they, you know, achieved any revenue whatsoever, right? Are they focused on, you know, these two or three specific spaces? And for example, you can say something like, has the founder already had a successful exit? I'm just kind of making this up, right? A lot of it, just like real estate, is there, you might look at 100, you know, properties, you might visit 10, you might put an offer on three, and then you might buy one, right? It's the same principle. You can't avoid the work. You have to maintain that discipline, or you can end up buying something that is a limit, you know, at the end of the day. And I think that principle applies true no matter what space you're investing in. And so putting in those reps and sharing those reps with others is important. But, you know, to your point, that collective collaboration allows you to go through that 100, you know, to 10, to 3, to 1 a lot faster.
I mean, basically what it sounds like is that we're talking about the concept that in Black American communities and in just Black diasporic communities all over the world has been, you know, with us since the beginning of time, which is it takes a village. And I think that especially as minorities in whatever minority layer or identity level that you are at and that you identify with in whatever area of capitalism that you live and frequent in, it takes a village to get this done. And that's what I really hear from you today about the concept of networking, the concept of going to find people who also are interested in investment, going to ask questions, even if you think the questions sound dumb or weird, to really get started. My last question for you is, so what are your thoughts, tips and tricks on how people get started? To me, it sounds like what you're saying is that in order to really get started in investment, you first need to build like your core financial competency of like, is your rent getting paid? Is the light bill good? Do you have some savings? But how to, in your words, how does one even start dabbling in this space?
Yes, that's a great question. And so I would say there's two pieces to it. I think the first is like there's education and then there's action, right? And I think these two things apply no matter what stage you're at, right? So education, you know, check out gravywealth.com. We have a newsletter that kind of dives into and tries to break out insights on various, call it lenses of generational wealth creation that people can relate to no matter where they are in their journey, for example, right? So we'll do, for example, you know, real estate. The first might be, hey, you're renting, you're trying to buy, right? You know, how do you buy your first property? And, you know, the basics you'll find online are, oh, you know, housing prices are up, it's tough, right? But what's useful is, hey, if you have an all cash offer, you're 206% more likely to win a bidding award. And here are two companies that allow you to put all cash offers in on properties and you pay nothing because they basically serve as a realtor and that's coming out of the seller's commission, right? That's helpful. That's useful, right? But then for someone else, it might be you are now looking to make money in real estate as an investor. You're not just trying to buy a home. You may not be accredited yet, but there's a platform called, for example, Ground Floor, which allows you to invest as little as $5 into, you know, individual properties. And there's a guy in our community, Harvard grad, who's been using the platform for 7 years and he's gotten solid returns. And he does a whole spiel on why he likes that platform, unpaid, unsponsored, but just kind of telling this story. And then you might have accredited investors and it's like, hey, I can invest 25K or more into real estate. We may say, hey, this is a platform called Cadre, which is recently acquired by CrowdStreet, but it's run by this young Black CEO who's brought in blue chip, you know, kind of senior executives from top real estate investment companies, and they buy and build, developments that return, you know, kind of best in class returns for investors, but you have to be accredited. Check them out. It's like, okay, cool. I can find something for me where it is. So I would say finding sources that are reputable, that understand your unique perspective, and then just learning and reading is number one. That's the education piece. Finding what then resonates with you based on your personal situation, because depending on where you are, if you're still paying off student loan debt, you probably want to pay off your debt before you start investing, right? And then once you get to that ground zero, your next thing is, okay, I want to save. And maybe I have some goals of, you know, maybe starting at 529 because I have, you know, I want to have a kid in the next 2 or 3 years, or, you know, I want to buy that home. Like, let me think about those immediate goals. And then you have folks that have kind of covered those bases and they're like, all right, my goal is to really create a legacy of generational wealth. And that game oftentimes comes down to access. And that's where the biggest parts of collaborative wealth building is in the education, where you have people who've done it or are doing it and they're sharing things with you as they would their cousin or their brother, like the insider track one, which Gravy is trying to bring. But the other piece is like, collectively, we can get access to Harvard's Enterprise Research Campus, right? Which was open to a very select few, but because we had that relationship and because we had the tools in the community to, you know, create an SPV, we were able to get on that cap table. So to answer your question, I think it's education and action. The education is something you should be doing no matter what level you're at. The action should be tailored to your unique circumstances. And then the collaboration is all about getting you the best access to education and investment opportunities, depending on where you are.
So what I hear is that even if you are not ready to action, you should always be educating yourself to put your put yourself in a position to action.
Absolutely. You should be having conversations. You should have a crew of people that you are comfortable having these conversations with, which, going back to like the origin story for Gravy, was why it was created. You know, we just weren't having real conversations that we should be having. So just having people to talk about, you're literally your colleague at work who you hang out with and do lunch. you know, you talk all the time about everything, but you don't talk about like, hey, you know, what are you doing with your stock options, right? Or, who are you using for your banking, right? You know, and what type of rates are you getting? You know, we just don't have those conversations intentionally, and we end up paying. And all those little costs associated with not understanding things early on build up, you know, and it creates a version of you who was proactively looking for these things and a version of you who kind of is reactively trying to make these moves, but not necessarily doing the research first. And over time, these two folks are in different places. And that's unnecessary, you know, loss, unnecessary missed opportunity.
Thank you so much for all of this insight. Where can we find you? Where can we stalk you on the internet? What is coming up for you and how can we support?
Yeah, well, we just relaunched a website, gravywealth.com. Check it out. Just sign up, get our free newsletter. We dive into these topics. Lexi's been a contributor about how she's built, you know, incredible sets of multiple streams of income, you know, as a public speaker. And you can just get insights from relatable people who are in situations similar to you, telling you what they're doing. Also OGs who've been there, kind of sharing what they're doing as if they're talking to a family member. So just sign up for that newsletter. We have a syndicate. So if you're an accredited investor, you can go to that same site, sign up to the syndicate and get access to investment opportunities. We are selected. We don't just let anyone in. But if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably, you know, someone who, you know, would be in our wheelhouse. And, you know, and kind of collectively build that power to get better access and cut bigger checks to have more meaningful influence. And then if you want to follow me on social media, Chairman Brandon is the @. Love to talk to people, love to communicate. You know, we're at the earliest stages of what we're looking to do. But the biggest thing is we're looking to really illuminate what has been what I feel way too opaque at a time of change that is, you know, the haves and the have nots. That divide is going to be bigger and bigger and bigger. We're, of course, you know, we're looking to counter the forces of that through curation, you know, collaboration, and ultimately, you know, investing together.
I love it. Thank you so much for joining us today and with these insights. And I think that we're going to have to bring you back in season 3 and like really just dive in to one of these topics and have like a masterclass on each one. What are your thoughts on that?
Would love to. That's what we do. So I partner with experts in this space. We did a survey of our community, and a lot of the folks in our community were interested in buying a business, acquiring a company.
Oh, okay.
As their next stage. So we'll do a whole, you know, masterclass just on that, hosted by someone who's been there and done that with a, you know, kind of cohort of peers who are, you know, are kind of focused on that as their next move. So diving deep is what I'm all about, you know, and I think what we're building is very complementary to what you're doing, Lexi. So I appreciate your partnership and anything I can do to be helpful and add value to your community. I would love to do it.
I am honored and I will take that. We will be in touch. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can listen to You Can Sit With Us episodes on Spotify. For more information, visit our website, lexib.com, and our LinkedIn account at LexiB. And make sure to follow our podcasts on Instagram @SitWithLexiB. And don't forget to subscribe to our Spotify channel.